You've been listening to 93.3 WNRB Wausau. Real life, real learning, real radio. Coming up next, a show the NSA always loves to listen into and stop tapping my phones. This is The Mike Cannon Show.
Warning, the views expressed on The Mike Cannon Show, or the segments brought to you on this indie media radio show do not necessarily reflect the views of WNRB nor WNRB's host.
This is my boomstick!
The Mike Cannon Show.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible. Where we go from there is a choice I leave to you.
Welcome to another edition of this indie media radio program, The Mike Cannon Show. This week's program is produced out of Glee Glee Studios West for 93.3 WNRB, Central Wisconsin's premier community radio station. Also, this first hour is produced for IndieMedia.org Madison, RadioForAll.net, Micropower, and community radio stations worldwide. Hope you enjoy it. Each Monday from 2 to 6 on 93.3 WNRB, we bring you alternative non-corporate radio reports from around the country and the world. These shows are all produced by other not-for-profit and or community radio stations like the one you're listening to now. We here on The Mike Cannon Show try to bring you voices you'll not hear on corporate-dominated media or the propaganda on the all-hate AM radio stations. And this week we got a full plate of good programming. But first, a little montage of what you'll be hearing if you stay tuned for the entire show this week. Hang on for some shotgunning.
A report out this week that the Bush administration is drafting plans for severe cuts in Congress for Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. That's going to be their big push after the November election with the new budget.
Look, because Israel occupies their country and holds thousands of their compatriots as kidnapped hostages in their dungeons. It's really very simple, except if you think only in a clock that goes back 4 weeks. If you know, and you're old enough to know better, that this origins of this conflict are not 4 weeks or 4 years or 14 years, but are decades old.
The United States has really badly forfeited any credibility it might have once had in the Middle East, and it has become that much more of a target for jihadists as a result of its support of Israel and Israel's destruction of Lebanese infrastructure, Lebanese civilian infrastructure, Lebanese civilian lives.
No justice, no peace. You're not going out of business as a newscaster in Jerusalem anytime soon, believe me.
Well, as usual, you have prompted a huge email response both for and against you, Mr. Galloway, so we'll leave it there. I have to say that some people might find it offensive when more families are mourning their dead to hear you say that it was a bloody good hiding.
You don't give a damn. You don't even know about the Palestinian families. You don't even know that they exist. Tell me the name of one member of the seven members of the same family slaughtered on the beach in Gaza by an Israeli warship. You don't even know their name, but you know the name of every Israeli soldier who's been taken prisoner in this conflict, because you believe, whether you know it or not, that Israeli blood is more valuable than the blood of Lebanese or Palestinians. That's the truth.
Four radio companies managed a double-digit percentage increase in market share across the country, and in those markets that experienced the most consolidation, radio journalists and producers suffered the most job losses. Those who survived the cutbacks found their wage growth slowed. Less local people on the air means less local content on the air. Clear Channel is leading a new push to allow greater radio consolidation as part of the FCC's new media ownership rules.
He spent the last month vociferously telling everyone he's a Democrat, and today he's telling people that the Democratic Party is irrelevant. I'm not sure that's going to fly. He does have one firm base of support in Connecticut, which has always been an independent state.
Specifically, is that by virtue of our registered nurse's license, we are supposed to advocate on behalf of patients. Now the Supreme Court is coming in and saying that we are using our independent judgment on behalf of the employer. My concern is that because this is a federal ruling, it will supersede our state licensure, so virtually gutting patient protections and the duty of the nurse to advocate for their patients.
The bottom line is the videotape is Josh's property. He should be under no obligation to be compelled to give up this private property. By doing so, all journalists are automatically deputized by the police to collect evidence for them. That's not Josh's job, nor should it be.
And now, the man who brought down Nixon, Mike Cannon.
So that was just a taste, a little teaser of what you'll be hearing throughout today's show. Before we bring you this week's first show, a little information I've discovered for you this week. Meeting in Honolulu, Hawaii this week, the ABA, also known as the American Bar Association, issued the following statement. Quote, "The American Bar Association opposes, as contrary to the rule of law and our constitutional system of separation of powers, the misuse of presidential signing statements." Unquote. Further, that the ABA, quote, "urges Congress to enact legislation requiring the President promptly to submit to Congress an official copy of all signing statements," unquote, he or she has issued. Yep, those liberal lawyers again trying to block our President's ability to change the laws as he see fits. The President has issued something like 800-plus presidential signing statements, about tripling the number of signing statements of all the previous presidents combined. The most famous signing statement came right after John McCain and Bush's Rose Garden meeting, where Bush praised McCain for his efforts to help stop torture by U.S. military personnel, then promptly wrote into law via the signing statements that said, "Well, the president at his discretion can torture whomever he wants." Thanks, McCain, for all that hard work you did on that law to end torture, and the president just gets to ignore it. You know, you're my hero. Next, here's a little funny something from our All Hate AM radio station here in town. Folks, if you ever wanted to hear a bunch of racist, homophobic, and misogynist people, and also just grossly misinformed people, just listen to these, quote, enlightened ones on AM talk radio. For all you out there who don't listen to it, you'd be pretty shocked. So I've decided from time to time to just tune in randomly. I'll try to bring you a little of the highlights, or rather lowlights, of these stations. Really, it's kind of hard to take, and I should get paid for having to listen to this stuff. So once in a while, I record some random stuff off the air, both nationally and locally for you. Then I'll try to filter through the mudslinging and bring you the best of, well, so to speak, the best of. This week's little piece is from the All Hate AM radio station local morning program. The first voice you'll hear is a caller talking about the World Trade Center bombing and how these types of people should be profiled. Now get this, people of Mediterranean descent. That's right, you Greek and Italian bombers who blew up the trade centers, we got our eyes on you now. Even more scary is the local expert response. Now, this lady is on every Friday's show, and wait until you hear who she thinks blew up the World Trade Center.
911 changed everything, and the terrorists haven't won. We just have to concede a little bit. We have to give up a little bit of luxury for our safety. It's well worth it. And another thing we should be doing is profiling. You know what? The World Trade Center wasn't blown up by Mickey Mouse or Donald Duck or a 96-year-old woman or a 6-month-old baby, which when I have taken my children on airplanes, I mean, they check their doggone diapers. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. The World Trade Center was blown up by Muslims. It was blown up by
people from Pakistan.
Mediterranean descent. They look Mediterranean. It wasn't blown up by Donald Duck or a guy that looks like me.
And they were Pakistani, and that's the same people that just tried to do this last one the other day. It's the same thing. It's the same people.
We have to...
That is 17 of the 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia, not Pakistan. Ah, Saudi, Pakistan, hell, what is the difference after all? Just a couple thousand miles. Well, on to this week's show. Each week about this time, I try to bring you a great weekly news and review program to counter the Sunday morning yak shows you might have caught on television. Here's a great show called Eat a State out of Seattle, Washington, with alternative reports about this week's events I bet you did not hear much about on corporate media. As always, I'd like to thank you for tuning into this Indie Media Radio program, The Mike Cannon Show. Here is Eat the State.
It is 8:31, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning to you. It's good to be back.
It's good to have you back. How was the trip?
The trip was fine. We drove 8,000 miles, and you know, contributed to the record oil company profits. And to mentioned a couple weeks ago, we saw a lot of evidence of global warming, and of course, I helped contribute to that. That was a good thing. And
good for you.
Yeah, and I'm really glad we didn't fly, as it turned out. And I suppose we'll be talking about that and about the oil companies also later on in the show. So, got a lot to cover today.
All right, so were you close by when Joe Lieberman had to throw in the towel?
No, we'd actually fled New England by that point, but it was still great news, even though Counterspin mentioned in the last half hour, the Beltway pendidocracy seemed pretty appalled, as they had all through the Ned Lamont candidacy. It really was a triumph for democracy in that an incumbent who was seriously out of step with his own constituents. I mean, poll after poll has shown not just the Democrats. I mean, you know, you had all of these Beltway pundits saying that it was, you know, radical anti-war extremists were fueling the Ned Lamont campaign. Well, you know, every poll that's out there now is showing that 60% of the American public opposes this war. That's the mainstream. And Lieberman is out of touch with the mainstream. He was not a centrist. He was an extremist. He was in lockstep with the Bush administration, and we saw that after the election, where he's basically going out as an independent candidate, repeating the Republican National Committee and Bush administration talking points, both on Iraq and on Ned Lamont and on the Democratic Party, trashing the Democratic Party, and yet you're still seeing, you know, to their credit, the Democrats on Capitol Hill have by and large endorsed Lamont in the election and said they'll stand by him. But and Maria Cantwell included, which was certainly a concern since Cantwell is very much a quote-unquote moderate like Lieberman. But at the same time, they're all saying nice things about Joe, which Joe can use in his campaign ads, of course. And they're keeping Joe in the Democratic caucus, even though he has officially left the Democratic Party and is going on national TV and trashing the Democratic Party. You know, he's still got all his committee assignments. He's still got all the perks that come with being a Democrat, even though he is, opposing the candidate that was supported by the Connecticut State Democratic electorate. All that being said, I think it's a tremendous shot in the arm for grassroots Democratic Party activists all over the country. And the Connecticut election obscured the fact that congressional members in Michigan and Georgia also lost in their primaries on Tuesday. And that combined with the Lamont candidacy, and remember that he was below 20% in the polls like 3 months ago. I mean, he really came on very, very strong. It shows that there is not just tremendous anger at the Bush administration and people like Lieberman who have associated themselves with the Bush administration, but with Congress and with incumbents in general. And if that momentum can be kept up between now and November, you could see a real sea change in what Congress and Capitol Hill looks like come next January.
All right. Moving along, the federal court ruling this week that will affect all of us.
Yeah, this didn't get a whole lot of attention. Of course, it was a busy news week, but the U.S. District Court in Eastern Virginia ruled on a kind of obscure case involving a couple of AIPAC members who have been charged in connection with an Israeli espionage case. But the ruling in this case is pretty disturbing. It is that the Espionage Act covers anyone who knowingly receives and transmits classified information. And now you think about this. This could also include any reporter, for example, who knowingly receives and transmits classified information, such as the Secret Army investigational report of Abu Ghraib or the Washington Post report on the CIA gulag of prisons in Eastern Europe or the New York Times report on the NSA spying scandal. You know, all of those reporters now could, under this ruling, conceivably be charged with espionage, with treason, as a result of this ruling, if it holds up under appeal, which, you know, it very well may. Interestingly enough, the judge in this case, a guy named T.S. Ellis III, is a Reagan appointee. It really underscores how a full generation of conservative court appointees, and that includes under Clinton, because Clinton vetted most of his federal court appointees with conservative Republicans, has really has the potential to damage things long term, and it underscores why people in Connecticut were upset with Lieberman. It wasn't just the war. It was a host of different ways in which he and other establishment Democrats have sided with the Republican agenda. Lieberman opposed filibuster efforts for both Roberts and Samuel Alito when their nomination to the Supreme Court, and he's voted for virtually every federal judge appointee and of the Bush administration. And, you know, that kind of those kind of votes can come back to haunt us for decades, and we see that with rulings like this.
All right. And the Bush administration is working on Medicare, but the timing seems a little odd.
Yeah, a couple interesting reports on Bush administration plans for upcoming congressional session, since Congress only has something like 15 working days left in the calendar year. Must be nice to have a job like that. But a report out this week that the Bush administration is drafting plans for severe cuts in Congress for Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. That's going to be their big push after the November election with the new budget in January of 2007, after Bush has become a lame duck and, you know, doesn't have to worry about answering to voters. Of course, after the presidential election in 2004, trying to privatize Social Security was Bush's big push, and he failed. They're coming back after that again, and also going after Medicare and Medicaid. The new Treasury Secretary announced this talk this week about how that was the biggest threat to the economy, and they're clearly prioritizing that. So keep an eye on that. Also, a Washington Post report went on Wednesday that the Bush administration has drafted amendments to the War Crimes Act that would retroactively prohibit policymakers from possible criminal charges for authorizing any humiliating and degrading treatment of prisoners, torture, for example, etc., according to lawyers who have seen the proposal. The draft legislation, according to these lawyers, policymakers who would be retroactively covered to ignore the Geneva Conventions, even though the U.S. Supreme Court just ruled a couple of months ago that that was the law of the land. So once again, the Bush administration trying to not only subvert the will of Congress, which passed the bill, you know, last December outlawing torture, but also the U.S. Supreme Court. It really is once again, you know, the imperial presidency come to fruition. And it's one reason that people are so upset with Congress, is because it has rolled over and played dead for the Bush administration for the last 6 years.
All right. Well, from the Timing is Everything department, we heard this week that BP Oil is saying that their pipeline is kind of wearing out.
Yeah, and there are some very good reports out there. Greg Palast and Jason Leopold, both of whom have experience reporting on energy issues in Alaska, have both had very, very good material out on this. And also there's a whistleblower. There have been whistleblowers coming out for BP for the last 15 years, basically saying that the pipeline is corroded, that BP isn't putting money into maintenance of the system, that there's a real severe possibility of a major environmental disaster along the lines of Exxon Valdez. This has been brought to the attention of federal regulators, particularly under the Bush administration, who have chosen to ignore it. It really is a tale of horrible mismanagement of an environmentally sensitive area for a number of years, and it's been very, very well documented. But BP did choose at the beginning of the the week to announce that it would shut down its Prudhoe Bay oil operations. Of course, they then announced on Friday, after oil had gone up a couple of dollars a barrel, that they could, in fact, redo it on the western half of their Prudhoe Bay operation. They would only shut down the eastern half. Now, it's the western half, mind you, the half that they're going to restart again with the a wink and a nod from federal regulators, that was the site of a massive oil leak in March, 250,000 gallons that went on, you know, went on to the Alaskan tundra. But that supposedly is okay now. And they've had the technology to check all of this, the so-called smart pig, for a number of years, but they haven't bothered to invest in it. So why now, you have to ask? Well, there's a couple of interesting reasons. Number one, it's summertime. There's already crises in the Middle East, which we'll obviously get to. And oil is much more expensive now than it was even you know, 3 years ago. And because it's summertime and therefore a time of peak demand, you have the opportunity, and Ron Style, to manipulate the market. Now, a lot of Alaskan oil happens to go here to the West Coast, which I can attest from my recent drive and from being in, you know, Memphis, Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia a couple of months ago, that we have some of the most expensive gas in the country here on the West Coast. That's becoming even more expensive now because much of our gas comes from Prudhoe Bay, and they're you know, going to raise the prices as a result. Now, as it happens in California, which is by far the largest market on the West Coast, by far the largest distributor is ARCO, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of BP. So guess who wins at both ends? They both drive up the price at the wholesale end of how much oil costs a gallon because they're withholding oil from the market, and then at the retail end they make money from that as well. Now the other part of that, and then they're going to turn around and restart operations, so they still get to sell some of the oil after all. Now in terms of the rest of the shutdown, which they say is going to last until early next year, that happens to last until just after the Bush administration is freed up to do things and at the end of the midterm elections, such as, for example, invading Iran. You know, other things that could raise the price of oil right after they have more of it to sell. So there's a number of ways in which the timing of this is very, very suspicious, and it underscores once again how dangerous drilling in Anwar would be, because it's the exact same consortium of operators, BP in the lead. It's the exact same technology, and it's just as or even more environmentally sensitive than Prudhoe Bay is.
All right. Well, moving along, the other big item of the week was the terror plot that was supposedly foiled from planes coming over from the UK.
Yeah, and
no more liquids.
Yeah, and it does look like a serious plot. Now, I have to say at this point that I couldn't have flown home if I'd needed to, because I have a immunosuppressant medication that I have to take twice a day in order to survive, and it is a liquid, and I'm not about to check it on the airlines and have them lose it because it costs something like $1,300, you know, per prescription, and I can't just walk into a pharmacy somewhere on the other side of the country and reorder it. There are a lot of people who are being massively inconvenienced by the knee-jerk reaction in terms of the security at the airports as a result of this plot. And it is a serious plot. At the same time, let's remember a couple of things. Number one, British authorities stopped this plot using investigative police powers. And not only that, but police powers that they had prior to 9-1-1. Nothing that has happened in the last 5 years did anything to enhance for the British police authority to stop this plot. They did it as a result of basic investigative work. Not without additional curtailments of civil liberties, without military action, etc. In fact, you can almost certainly make the argument that as these were apparently British citizens who launched this plot, it was made much more possible by actions that have been taken in the past 5 years, namely all the things that the U.S. in particular has done to incite more people to want to wage jihad against the West and against the United States. In terms of the security precautions that are now being taken in U.S. airports, you know, it's kind of preposterous. I mean, you know, what is the benefit versus what is the risk? You're never going to be able to entirely prevent terrorist attacks. You try and minimize it, and the best way to minimize it is by a couple things, by intelligence and police work, number one, and by you know, winning the hearts and minds so that you have fewer of these people trying to wage a jihad and less of a population that broadly supports them in the Muslim world. In terms of the security precautions, well, I mean, what are you going to do? Are you going to drain people's bodies of blood because it's a liquid? I mean, it becomes preposterous at a point. All Al-Qaeda would need is a surgeon and an anesthesiologist who'd be willing to do it, and you could put a container with some sort of explosive and a computer chip with a timer on it in somebody's abdominal cavity, or do it to about 15 or 20 willing martyrs, and they can go walking right through an airport screener. They can just say they've got some shrapnel in their spine or a pacemaker or whatever if the metal detector goes off. And there's absolutely nothing you can do to prevent it. There are ways, if a group like Al-Qaeda wants to bring down an airliner, that it always will be done. The threat of liquid explosives was used in a plot that was uncovered more than a decade ago out of the Philippines. I mean, it's been a known tactic. It was just as much of a danger a week ago as it is now. So a lot of this is being done for show, just as the terror alerts are being done for show, just as the Bush administration used the advanced knowledge of the news to launch partisan attacks on Democrats for being weak on terror midweek this week. Dick Cheney in particular, not surprisingly, leading that, but also Ron Mailman at the Republican National Committee and several other people. It really is a case where this is being overblown for political purposes, number one, where the very real threat that exists has been part of a need to prevent terror that has really been subverted by the Bush administration, by the war in Iraq, rather than trying to go directly after Osama bin Laden and after Al-Qaeda, by all of the things that have been done in the Middle East, including Iraq, including our mindless support of Israel. Those are the two biggest that have continued to incite a new generation of Muslims to want to try and come after us. This administration has been a disaster for foreign policy, and this plot shows it. It's very sad.
All right. Well, that leads us over to international and the continuing situation in Lebanon.
Yeah, good news this morning, apparently, that UN Security Council last night unanimously passed a resolution crafted by the U.S. and France that would send 15,000 more better funded, better trained UN peacekeeper force to southern Lebanon, to a 15-mile buffer zone between the border and the river that Israel had threatened earlier this week to invade up until. At the same time, the Lebanese government has pledged to match that with an additional 15,000 of its own security forces to help patrol that buffer region to keep out, you know, anybody who could attack Israel, basically. But you have to ask several questions. The most prominent of them is why this couldn't have happened a month ago. And the biggest reason it couldn't have happened a month ago is that the United States was giving diplomatic cover to Israel and was threatening to veto in the Security Council any resolution that was not to Israel's liking. And Israel wanted to be able to wage this war for a certain period of time and attack Lebanon for a certain period of time before it agreed to any ceasefire, which apparently this will represent. Israel has said it's acceptable to them. Hezbollah has been saying since the inception that they would be amenable to a ceasefire if it were guaranteed, if Israel abided by it. There was a report in the San Francisco Chronicle this week, for example, that the bombing and invasion of Lebanon had been planned for 2 years, that this was a plan that was sitting on the shelf waiting to be implemented when the Israeli leadership felt there was an opportune moment, and that opportune moment came with the killing of 8 soldiers and kidnapping of 2 others on the border about a month ago. And you know, as we've said all along, the media coverage of this has been horrible because there have been border incursions on both sides pretty regularly, particularly both the Israelis into Lebanon over the last 6 years or so. Now we have evidence that this is a pre-existing plan by Israel to do this, and the Hezbollah attack was a pretext for it. That has not gotten widespread media coverage at all. We've seen Condi Rice, who had to cancel her trip to Beirut after the Qana bombing a couple of weeks ago because even the Lebanese prime minister said basically that Condoleezza Rice was not welcome in his country, which is a remarkable statement to say. Rice is talking about the birth of a new Middle East, looking, you know, something like the Birth of a Nation video, movie by, D.W. Griffith. The United States has really badly forfeited any credibility it might have once had in the Middle East, and it has become that much more of a target for jihadists as a result of its support of Israel and Israel's destruction of Lebanese infrastructure, Lebanese civilian infrastructure, Lebanese civilian lives. We have word now from the UN this week that an oil spill that was caused by the bombing of a power plant, which, by the way, is a war crime, it's the bombing of civilian infrastructure, could have resulted in an oil spill on the Lebanese beaches, which has been unfolding for a couple of weeks now, that's on the scale of Exxon Valdez in terms of the impact on the environment and on marine life and so forth in the Mediterranean. This has just been a disaster all the way around. It's profoundly changed the balance of power within Lebanon. Syria still is at risk of getting involved. And we also have not heard very much in this country, but the largest anti-Israeli demonstrations in the world for the past couple of weeks have been in Baghdad. This has been a profound turning point also in terms of the relationship of the U.S. to both the Iraqi government and the already unpopular American presence among Iraqi civilians. So it's been a very bad situation all the way around, and you have to ask why the ceasefire couldn't have happened much earlier.
All right, moving along, while you were gone, I'm sure you were surprised to see that apparently the Joint Chiefs of Staff have discovered that there might be a civil war happening in Iraq.
Yeah, it's kind of a shock. The Baghdad morgue, for example, reported this week that there were 1,815 deaths in the Baghdad area in the month of July. That's a new record, eclipsing by 250 the previous record, which was in June. Most of those are violent deaths. Most of those are executions by death squads. The situation has continued to spiral out of control. As I talked about a couple of weeks ago, the whole plan by the Bush administration to put an extra whopping 4,000 American troops in Baghdad is really pretty much a publicity gimmick. It's a drop in the bucket compared to what would actually be needed to bring any kind of security to a city of 5 million people that's disintegrating before our eyes, and people are trying to flee the country pretty much any way they can at this point. It's a very, very dangerous situation within Iraq right now. And as we mentioned, that also has been exacerbated by the situation with Israel and Lebanon. There have been several other sort of crises developing in the Muslim world and with the Muslim relationship with the West that have not gotten much attention either because of the Lebanon crisis. Turkey has been threatening to invade northern Iraq where the Kurds are because the Kurds have been giving shelter to separatist Kurds in southeast Turkey who have been waging a guerrilla war for a long time against the Turkish military and the Turkish government. At the same time, we also have India threatening reprisals against Pakistan for Pakistan's alleged role in helping to bankroll and train the people behind the Mumbai bombings last month. Now, this is the same Pakistan, of course, where there was an alleged connection to the British plot that was uncovered this week, yet these guys are our close friends. So you have right now the U.S. throwing a match onto a pile of gasoline called Israel, Gaza, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India. Of those, Israel, Pakistan and India are all nuclear powers. Iran would like to be, and, you know, we, of course, have threatened to use nuclear weaponry against Iran, and it's been seriously discussed at high levels of the Pentagon and the administration. That, incidentally, is certainly still on the table. The U.S. talking about, or the Bush administration talking about the possibility of a military strike against Iran. And in fact, very interesting statement this week by Colonel Wilkerson, the former chief of staff to Colin Powell during the first Bush term, and this is a direct quote. He's questioning whether, quote, questions whether this entire affair, talking about the Israeli bombing and potential invasion of Lebanon, this entire affair was ginned up by Bush Cheney and certain political leaders in Tel Aviv to give cover for the eventual attack by the U.S. on Iran. Now, isn't that an interesting scenario? We got a real mess right now in the Middle East, and yeah, again, it's very much connected also to the terror plot that was uncovered this week in Britain. So, chickens coming home to roost and all that kind of thing.
Okay, very briefly, Mexico and the recount.
Yeah, we heard a little bit of that on Counterspin, so I won't spend too much time on it. The Election Tribunal ordering a recount of 9% of the ballots rather than all of them. Really only the ones where the numbers didn't add up. They didn't go for any of the precincts where extensive reports of fraud were taking place. And this is not likely to mollify Lopez Obrador's supporters, 2 million of whom rallied in Mexico City a couple of weeks ago to a call for civil disobedience and sit-ins if every vote were not recounted. So this story is not going to go away anytime soon.
Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish, co-editor of Eat the State, and where do people find Eat the State?
You can also find us on the web at www.eatthestate.org.
And now, the man who brought down Nixon, Mike Cannon.
That was Eat the State out of Seattle, Washington. Up next, World Report out of Canada. This week's 13-minute report will be talking about a lot of the missteps taken by the Bush administration and how that is playing out in the world and the loss of prestige and dominance in many aspects of global diplomacy. That is what we do for you each week, bring you non-corporate voices from around the country and the world. As always, if you have any questions, comments, and concern about this show, please feel free to contact me at themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. That's all one word, themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. Here is World Report.
Is the U.S. still the world's only superpower? And what does that mean, anyway? The U.S. is certainly not the only country to be motivated by national grandeur, ideological fulfillment, religious messianism, economic aggrandizement, regional domination, or global standing. France, Germany, Russia, China, and India come to mind. Brazil, Argentina, Venezuela. Even Canada has developed a sudden interest in projecting power, although the reasons why are still in the undisclosed part of the Harper agenda. Huntington describes the U.S. as the only superpower with overwhelming dominance in virtually every category of power, whether it's military, economic, technological, cultural, diplomatic, or what have you. But U.S. dominance has taken several big hits in the last few weeks, mostly in the areas of diplomacy, trade, and politics, while the lesson that military might cannot do it all continues to be ongoing. After the Rome summit on Lebanon failed to produce anything but an Israeli declaration that no action was as good as a green light, the New York Times on July 25th accused Condoleezza Rice of foot-dragging and called the pledge of humanitarian aid, quote, much too little and extremely late, end quote. Just as a point of reference, the Israeli soldiers were captured on July 12th and the Beirut airport bombed on the 13th. Rice arrived in the Middle East 10 days later on the 23rd. Then France and Iran stepped into the diplomatic vacuum after the Khana bombing on the 30th, with visits to Beirut by their foreign ministers when Lebanon told the Secretary of State they had canceled her visit. France does not list Hezbollah as a terrorist organization, while Israel continued to treat diplomacy as a last resort and the United States criticized Iran for supporting Hezbollah. Mr. Philippe Douste-Blazy, the French foreign minister, said Iran could play a, quote, stabilizing role, end quote, in the Middle East. Meanwhile, Mark Malik Brown, a British diplomat promoted this year to Deputy Secretary General of the UN, provoked one U.S. spokesman to anger when he told the Financial Times that Bush and Blair should, quote, know not just when to lead, but when to follow, allowing France, among others, to share the lead, end quote. In the end, the French have joined the U.S. in presenting a draft resolution to the Security Council. Lebanon has rejected it because it allows Israeli soldiers to remain on Lebanese soil. But that's another story. In a recent interview with Jim Lehrer, E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post joined the chorus of those who now admit that the U.S. is losing influence as a result of the Iraq War and then referred delicately to, quote, the administration's tendency to stay away from diplomacy, end quote. Charles Freeman, a former U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia, says that the Bush administration has used the principle of avoiding the international players it finds most objectionable in North Korea, burying any contact in the six-party talks, while counting on China to use its influence, even though our interests are not the same as Beijing's, and toward Iran, where we've subcontracted diplomacy to the Europeans because we won't talk to Tehran. Just as the invasion of Lebanon was beginning, the G8 convened its annual meeting, this time in St. Petersburg. M.K. Bhadrakumar, a retired diplomat from India, provided an interesting perspective. Quote, Putin indirectly drew attention to the U.S. isolation when he said Russia's advantage was that it did not close its doors to any parties to the Middle East conflict. Putin asserted that Russia's regular contacts with Hamas and Hezbollah actually helped to work on the G8's Middle East resolution. If this in itself wasn't an extraordinary statement, Putin rubbed it in. Iran, of course, he said, is an influential country in the region, and its interests must be respected so as to prompt it to use its influence to change the situation in Lebanon for the better, end quote. The most significant point made by Putin, in Bhadrakumar's opinion, was that the deployment of any international force in Lebanon must be on the basis of a mandate from the UN Security Council, and that Russia would participate in any such operations, but, quote, we first need to get the agreement from all the sides involved in the conflict, end quote. All in all, Bhadrakumar continued, the G8 revealed the erosion in the United States' ability to bend the world to its will. The U.S. exposed itself as having very little leverage in the Middle East situation. It also failed to get the G8 to fall in line on energy security or the Iran nuclear issue. End quote. On July 24th, at the beginning of that same week, the World Trade Organization's last opportunity to save the Doha round before Bush's special trade promotion authority to fast-track an agreement past the U.S. Congress expires came to nothing. Six key members of the World Trade Organization, the United States, the European Union, Japan, Australia, Brazil, and India, decided to bring an end to the Doha round of trade talks. IPS News reported that in India there was rare unity amongst diverse groups who believed that the decision for India to quit the Doha round was a good one. Eileen Kwa of Focus on the Global South reported that despite formal declarations of regret, outside the meeting, a few developing country delegates she spoke to could barely contain their euphoria. One delegate cautioned against prematurely labeling the round as dead. He said he would believe it, quote, only when he sees it, end quote. He was clearly delighted, but said he should contain it, quote, while I'm still here in the WTO compound, end quote. Plans are underway to try to save the Doha round this September in Brazil. Even if they're successful, numerous events are coming together now to reveal the limits of Washington's ability to become the unquestioned political and military arbiter of the globalizing world economy. While the Doha round failed to gain traction, Prime Minister Maliki of Iraq, a Shia who spent much of his life in Damascus, has not supported Israel's actions and has refused to denounce Hezbollah as a terrorist organization. This week, several hundred thousand Shias demonstrated solidarity with Hezbollah in Baghdad. Several thousand more did the same in Saudi Arabia, where demonstrations are illegal. Looking beyond Lebanon and Iraq, a recent editorial in the Baltimore Sun found that, quote, symptoms of failure are becoming harder to deny in Afghanistan. The Taliban is resurgent in the south, probably in part because of support from within Pakistan. Hundreds of civilians have died in fighting this year, including some killed in NATO bombing raids. President Hamid Karzai has told two governors to rearm their private militias, which is a big step backward, but indicative of the weakness of the Afghan police. Drought is once again afflicting the north, pushing farmers either to move or to concentrate on the one crop that doesn't need much irrigation, the opium poppy. And Mr. Karzai has reportedly given his blessing to the reincarnation of a department for the promotion of virtue and suppression of vice. The Western nations, distracted by Iraq and now Lebanon, have stumbled badly in Afghanistan. The Western presence has not significantly improved schools, roads, order, or prosperity, but it has encouraged prostitution and alcohol consumption. A week ago Thursday, Mr. Karzai attended a three-way summit of neighbors in Tajikistan. The third neighbor was Mahmoud Ahmadinejad of Iran. The U.S., the Baltimore Sun editorialist warns, could still lose in Afghanistan. End quote. None of these, neither Iraq nor Lebanon nor Afghanistan, can be claimed as a wildly successful operation. If it seems that American influence is in decline where diplomacy and trade are concerned, let's not forget that Lebanon was one of the celebrated color revolutions. In fact, just a few days ago, the Ukrainian parliament approved former President Viktor Yanukovych as prime minister. Yanukovych won 271 votes from the 450 deputies in parliament. He and his allies, who now include the president's Our Ukraine party, also dominate the country's new cabinet. However, under the Constitution, President Viktor Yushchenko has control of key ministries such as foreign affairs and defense. With the continuing trouble in Lebanon and separatist uncertainty in a number of provinces in Georgia, the policy of using pseudo-NGOs like the National Endowment for Democracy to influence elections and train activists may cost the U.S. its political dominance, too. On this side of the pond, the Organization of American States is a moderate, pro-American organization of governments in the Western Hemisphere. On July 28th, its human rights branch, the Inter-American Human Rights Commission, urged the U.S. to close the Guantanamo Bay facility without delay. In 2002, shortly after detainees began to arrive, that commission granted what it calls precautionary measures in favor of the detainees at Guantanamo Bay, requesting that the United States take the, quote, urgent measures necessary to have the legal status of the detainees at Guantanamo determined by a competent tribunal, end quote. Since then, the Commission has held three hearings and has reiterated the measures to the United States on four separate occasions. The Commission also amplified the measures to include possible torture or other cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment of detainees at Guantanamo Bay and the possible removal of detainees to jurisdictions such as Syria where they could be subjected to torture. The U.S. has responded by saying that the Commission doesn't have jurisdiction in the matter. In February 2006, the United Nations Human Rights Commission urged the United States to close the facility without further delay. The United Nations Committee Against Torture made similar recommendations in May 2006. On June 29, 2006, in the case of Hamdan v. Rumsfeld, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the military commissions that the United States proposed to use to try the detainees at Guantanamo Bay, based in part upon concerns that the commissions did not satisfy the minimum protections under Common Article 3 to the Geneva Conventions. Clearly, the U.S. is not conducting the orchestra. On the contrary, it is behaving like any other partisan with some allies. The U.S. does not determine who is isolated and who is not. The U.S. does not determine who is legitimate and who is not. So much for this Monday. For more, point your browser to cjly.net/worldreport, and to contact me, email earthling@cjly.net. or snail mail, box 767, Nelson, British Columbia, Canada, V1L5R4, Attention World Report. I'm Jim Terrell at Kootenai Co-op Radio. Thanks for listening.
And now, the man who doesn't misrepresent evidence to the UN, Mike Cannon.
Hope you've been enjoying this Mike Cannon Indie Media Radio Show for Central Wisconsin. This show airs every Monday from 2 to 6 on 93.3 WNRB, Central Wisconsin's number one community radio station. Now all our WNRB programming can be heard live on the web by checking out one of the links to our live web stream links. One of these links can be found at our blog site, which is at wnrb.blogspot.com. Feel free to go by and check it out.
If you don't, I will.
Stand by to receive our transmission.
Sticking with the war, up next a short 3-minute report from an anti-war demonstration in New Jersey last week. And the reporter will be talking with parents whose children are now serving in Iraq. After that, we'll play a short 3-minute piece I produced called This Week's Iraq Body Count. Here are more non-corporate voices from around your country speaking about topics that affect all of us. As always, I thank you for taking some time and listening to this, your only non-corporate controlled radio program for Central Wisconsin, The Mike Cannon Show.
Joanne Saul's son enlisted in the army as an engineer, but instead he has been conducting daily patrols in the Anbar province west of Baghdad for 8 months. She says he joined believing he would help protect the United States and also get an education, but soon realized his mistake.
When he first arrived in Camp Pitt, the people were friendly, and as the months went by, there were so many casualties that the people and even the officers in my son's unit spoke out publicly and said that we're only hurting the people here in Camp Pitt, and we should leave and let the people rebuild the country themselves. They're better off without us there. And my son's last call to me was very upsetting. And he said, Mom, he says, it's really bad. A lot of people are getting hurt. And he says, I gotta go. And he hung up the phone, and I haven't heard since. And I'm just waiting and waiting and upset. So the conditions have worsened in the last few months very, very much. The Iraqis want the people out. They just want to force them out. They feel that if we leave, that their insurgency will decrease. And even the American troops feel that way also. He was already hit by a roadside bomb. He was a gunner. Split his eardrum, and he got shell shock. And that's when they sent him to Camp Pitt for some reason. And he's been there ever since, conducting missions.
Every day?
Every day. Sometimes they don't sleep, he said. Yeah.
What are you asking that people here should do?
Well, I think everybody should call their senators, the congressmen, write letters, and demand that the troops come home, because if this war continues and if this administration has their way, there will be a draft sooner or later, because a lot of our troops are getting killed and wounded. People don't realize it, and their kids are going to have to go. And then I think finally when there is a draft, then maybe there will be public outcry.
Do you think the war is expanding now that there's a conflict between Israel and Lebanon?
I think that this war is going to escalate. I think we're going to go into Iran and Syria. I really think with this president, he's not afraid to say, bring him on again, because he's not the first one in line. He's sending our kids to do it. And yeah, I think Israel should pull out, and they should cease fire, and they should have some kind of agreement. The Hezbollah has really grown in numbers, and let them do what they want to do. Let live and let us live.
John Benton from Little Ferry, whose son Matthew died on May 1st in Iraq, stood for the first time on the vigil and said he regretted not having joined the Bring the Troops Home movement sooner. As car after car honked in support, a large sign provocatively proclaimed, 2,596 dead, had enough yet? Paula Rickhoven, who helped start the vigil after meeting with Cindy Sheehan, spoke of the goal of the coalition and the changing mood in the American public.
We specifically want our legislators to introduce or support legislation to bring the troops home now from Iraq. But they know that they have a constituency that wants the war ended and wants the troops out. And the people honking are truck drivers and landscapers. And the people who are not honking are waving or giving a peace sign. We've met with Senator Menendez and Senators Lautenberg, who have both said that they were strongly moved by the meetings, because, you know, when your kids are over there in the middle of these battles, you're desperate for the war to end, for the Iraqi people and for our own troops.
For the WBI Sunday News in Teaneck, New Jersey, this is Fred Gwynn.
You know you only had one shot to make it right, to do the right thing, so listen to the Mike Cannon Show.
Choice is an illusion created between those with power and those without. What do all men with power want? More power.
Now they knew who was master and leader. Sheep, thought I.
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
Remorse for what? You people have done everything in the world to me. Doesn't that give me equal right? I can do anything I want to you people at any time I want to, because that's what you've done to me. If you spit in my face and smack me in the mouth and throw me in solitary confinement for nothing, what do you think's going to happen when I get out of here? Well, I haven't done enough. I might be ashamed of that for not doing enough. For not doing enough. For not being more perceptive. For not being aware enough. For not understanding. For being stupid. Maybe I should have killed 400 or 500 people, then I would have felt better. And I felt like I really offered society something. I can, but I find more will in the world that I'm in than I do the tinsel. And the real world is the one I have to deal with every day. Believe me, if I started murdering people, they'd be not be left.
Chemical weapons threat, terrorists, dangerous, die, in turn, murders.
There are some who feel like that, you know, the conditions are such that they can attack us there. My answer is bring them on.
As of Monday, August 14th, 2006, 2,601 United States military personnel had died in Iraq since the start of the invasion. 19,270 United States military personnel had been wounded, over 9,000 of which had suffered grievous injuries such as amputations. 227 other coalition forces had also been killed.
Join us or die.
According to the British medical journal Lancet, over 100,000 Iraqi civilians had died since the start of the invasion.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
What do you see when you're in the dark and the demons come?
You are listening to a radio. Because of the time it takes for radio to travel to Earth from distant sources, radio astronomers are able to see the universe as it appeared more than 10 billion years ago. The artificial radio broadcast you are listening to now portrays the universe as it was just 1 second ago. Stay current. Listen to the Mike Cannon Show.